And we're live, people. Welcome back to the Tricks Podcast. I'm Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined by Seth Weintraub. How are you, Seth?
Good. Getting over some jet lag.
Yeah. We just came back this week from California, but that was early this week, so we're mostly fine right now. And speaking of California, Seth had a chance to test drive the Performance Model 3 during his little stop in L.A. How was it, Seth?
Yeah, it's a Model 3, so 98% of the experience of a Model 3. I probably should get the backstory is, we got a call from Tesla like a few days before I was going to L.A. and you were also going to L.A. saying that we have one time slot for you to take the Model 3 Performance out for a drive at basically 4 o'clock on a Friday in Los Angeles in the middle of West LA. And, you'll get 25 to... Actually, we got, an hour or so. But, if you look at West LA, we were in the Century City thing. It's pretty much just traffic for an hour in every direction. And at 4 o'clock on a Friday, it's the worst traffic. So it was kind of like, okay, we'll take it. But, you gave us one time slot in one location, so we'll take it. But, probably could not have picked a worse situation for testing a performance car.
Yeah, especially the performance version that
right.
That's what's bordering.
Everybody's got a Model 3 and, even some Model 3 all-wheel drive, tests are going on. But this is the performance car. This is the 0-60 in 3, it's like try to pick a worse spot. Think of traffic jams in the U.S., maybe Midtown Manhattan, but then you could just go the West Side Highway and you would at least get a 0-60 time. Here is in the middle of L.A., the only freeways nearby are the 405, which is jammed at 11:30 at night, let alone 4 o'clock on a Friday. Or, what I try to do is, I lived in L.A. for a decade. I know the place pretty well. I try to make a run for the PCH, Pacific Coast Highway. And I was thinking, maybe if I get out there quick enough, the Friday traffic won't have hit. But it was just deadlock getting out there. And so, I got a couple 0-60s, maybe, 0-50. And it was fast. It's not... the P100D ludicrous fast, it's not even P100D fast. It's like the same kind of you're just back in the seat and
you still get the G.
You get the G for sure. And I would almost say it's somehow smoother. Maybe it just, you don't get that immediate rear-ended feeling. You got rear-ended. But it's fast. And then, so there's other things with the Performance Edition that are pretty interesting. There's obviously the 20-inch wheels, which, on smooth roads are great. There's some performance tuning in the suspension. And there's better brakes. So, I got to test all of that pretty mildly. I did some turns, did some, acceleration. The person who I was driving with alerted me to the fact that she was car sick almost immediately and then a few times after that. So, it wasn't like a full test drive or even like a, give me 5 minutes and let me just go kind of thing. It was kind of like, okay, this is, this is a first, very first look at it and this is real kind of thing. So, I'm more than happy to answer questions. I did the post about it, which it kind of came up in the story I would rather have this than the high-end Model S or the high-end Model X because it's so light. And this is, the Model 3.
It's so light. It's not completely light, but it's so light compared to the Model S.
Comparatively. And it rides in a totally different way. You don't feel like you're in an armored car bolted to the ground. I don't think that the Model S is sluggish in any way, but it's heavy and when you make a turn it's substantial. Whereas this thing is kind of just popping around. And obviously parking is a lot better. You obviously don't have as much room but you just still have pretty good room. It seats five pretty comfortably. So, you know, my takeaway in that post was, for a lot of people, this is going to be the best car you can get at any price. So, you know, maybe me with my dad scene, like, I don't want the 20-inch tires. I'd rather have a little bit more spring, you know, maybe the 18-inch tires. But, you know, for the most part, I think that's going to be a lot of people's aspirational car. And that's kind of, that was my takeaway after sitting in traffic for an hour.
Yeah. Coming back to that, like you said, hopefully we're going to have another chance at testing out the car. What happened is that Tesla basically just gave real, I'm going to say, because that wasn't a real like performance test drive. It was like the same thing that the customer would get when going right now to the Tesla store, getting a test drive for the car, and even maybe even better than it, because depending on where you are and what time is it, you're gonna not gonna have the same experience in traffic as set. So Tesla just gave two real performance test drive to MKBHD on YouTube, and Dan Neal from the Wall Street Journal, and I mean, nothing against those guys, they're great at what they do, but unfortunately for MKBHD, it turned out just like a very short Instagram video. So like a cool look at the car, but very short, very to the point. We didn't learn a lot. And then Neil, he focused more on the Model 3 in general. So I don't think he reviewed the original Model 3, like the rear-wheel drive version. So it was more of a general review of the Model 3 instead of a focus on the performance version, even though he had the chance to test track mode like MKBHD did. So really, from the professional reviewers, we really didn't get much this time around. But, I mean, as usual with Tesla, we get a lot more from owners, normally from the actual fans of the cars. And deliveries are starting right now. They started yesterday, I think. Well, for sure this week. Timing exactly, like a lot of people are getting their delivery date right now. So in the next few days, you're gonna get a ton of stuff from the actual owners of the cars. And probably even people are going to bring it to the track. So we're going to get some real-world data on it. And we look forward to that. At the same time, so Tesla got a bunch of publicity this week because of that, because of the start of those little test drive thing. Not always great publicity, even though Seth got another great experience. The actual test drive review was quite positive, we'll say. And it looks like it resulted in a lot of orders for Tesla, because they ended up this week delaying the delivery timeline for new orders of the Model 3. So that was a story we wanted to talk about real quick, because as you know, in North America, Tesla used to have 1 to 3 months delivery windows for performance version and the long range rear-wheel version, which was the one that was already in production at 5,000 units per week. So it made sense that Tesla was able to churn it out pretty fast. But earlier this week, they increased that to a 2 to 4 months delivery window, and they kept the 2 to 4 months for the long range dual motor non-performance version. So now all cars are 2 to 4 months in North America, which is a pretty large delivery window. I mean, there's room to play with, but you won't get a car within 2 months when it comes to Model 3 for new orders, which are open, as you know now, to anyone. No reservation process anymore. One of the things that I think a lot of people are going to be curious to know from those real-world experience with the performance Model 3 and the all-wheel drive non-performance version is going to be, how is going to be the range, really? Because as you guys know, they are advertised at 310 miles of range on a single charge based on the EPA estimate, which is the same as the rear-wheel drive long-range version, but everything points to the two new version being a lot less efficient than the old one. So we published a report this week called Here's How Tesla Played with the EPA Readings to Advertise All Model 3 Version with 310 Miles of Range, which is quite a mouthful. Probably should have worked on a better headline than that. But the point, it's to the point, which is that Tesla played a lot with the numbers in order to advertise all cars at 310 miles of range, and they're not 310 miles of range. The long range version, as you guys know, Tesla reduced. We discussed that a lot in the past. Tesla has the EPA to, because the test ended up at 334 miles of range, and they asked the EPA to reduce it to 310 miles of range. So for a while, we're just trying to figure out why Tesla did that. And without knowing anything about the two new versions that were coming, we knew that they were coming, but we didn't know anything in terms of specs. We thought that the most likely explanation is that by reducing it to 310 miles, it would be more accurate. It would be easier for people to achieve that in the real-world conditions. So they were just trying to be more accurate, not to oversell the capacity of the vehicle.
But we thought maybe that they weren't, you know, doing a little bit of anti-selling because they didn't want to really cannibalize sale of the Model S 100D.
Yeah, that's a good point too. Yeah, that could have been it. One of the other would have made sense. But now that we got all the information for the dual motor and performance version, which Tesla also advertised at 310 miles of range, but in the EPA test, it shows that the efficiency of the car is actually different with a 29 kilowatt hour per 100 miles instead of the 26 kilowatt hours per 100 miles of the rear-wheel drive version show. So actually, on the road, on the test, they're not as efficient. So how do they get the same mile advertised range? Based on the test, if you use the same, because how it works, yeah, you get an actual range on the test, then they use a multiplier to reduce the range to the advertised range. The standard multiplier that the EPA used is 70%. So they use 70% of the range that they get on the test to advertise that. Tesla used the 70% for the long-range version, but they used 70.32 for the all-wheel drive versions. So that gave it a little boost because they were getting 308 with the 70%. So they get that two more miles with just a 0.3% differential on the multiplier, which isn't much. But so you won't really see the difference when you're driving the car if you're driving close to average conditions, really. But what that indicates is that Tesla was really pushing to get that 310 miles of range for the EPA estimate. And it's perfectly okay to do that. And officially, the way they say it is that you can work with the EPA to determine a new multiplier that's more realistic with the specific vehicle. So assuming that Tesla really did that and the 70.32 is a better multiplier for the all-wheel drive version, you should really get 310 miles of range EPA estimate. So if you drive like average conditions and you're not too heavy footed on the accelerator, you should be able to get that. But we all know that the long range version is not a case for that. If you are careful driving with the long range version, you should be able to get a lot more than 310 miles of range. We reported on someone that got 375 miles of range at highway speed, 70 miles per hour, which is like a good highway speed. So now it brings up the question: should Tesla? Is it okay that for Tesla to do that, or should they just represent the best, most accurate range possible?
I think they should just do the most accurate range possible. We're all, you know, adults here. We can kind of just deal with it. I don't think anybody's gonna, you know, if they said 308 miles on the performance version and the all-wheel drive version, I don't think anybody here would say, you know, that extra 2 miles, I need that. I'm gonna go with the. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, the long range is like 20 something more miles. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, like, I feel like Tesla kind of sold itself short on the long range because it gets really close to the Ioniq electric, which is the most fuel efficient or, you know, electricity efficient car on the road. And it's got a better, the long range has a better highway at 123 to 122 miles per gallon E. But the Ioniq electric has 150 miles per gallon E on, versus 136. So I think it's still pretty close. But, you know, like Tesla would have the opportunity to say, hey, look, this is the most efficient car on the road in the U.S. on the highway. Like if you're doing a road trip, this is the most efficient car. And they kind of pass that up so that their performance version looks a little better.
Yeah, because that's our thinking right now. I mean, Tesla didn't deny it, but he didn't confirm it. That what they did is that they looked at it, instead of looking at it as advertising the most accurate range possible, they looked at it from a marketing standpoint where they wanted to advertise the same range for the dual. They didn't want to advertise a lower range for the dual motor version, which are more expensive than they do for the rear-wheel drive version, which is less expensive. So from a marketing standpoint, it makes sense. But I think from a consumer standpoint, you just want to know what's going to be the range that you should get based on average. Of course, it's different for everyone depending on how you drive and everything. But, I mean, I don't think it's a great way to look at it, really.
Yeah, it's also kind of weird. It makes me think that maybe Tesla is not done mileage-wise with the all-wheel drive. Because as we know, when Tesla had that Model 3, or sorry, the D event with the Model S, they Elon Musk noted that the D actually had better range because they could do some tricks than the rear-wheel drive version. So it's actually kind of strange in this case that the all-wheel drive version has worse range.
You mean optimizing the torque with the front motor versus the rear motor?
Right, having different gear ratios and all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's more each different, the front motor versus the back motor, they have a different efficiency, a different speed. So you want to transfer the torque to the motor that has the, yeah, you should probably close the phone. to have the motor that is putting out the torque at the speed that it's more sufficient at. So they actually managed to get an efficiency gain on the all-wheel drive version versus the rear-wheel drive version for the Model S and the Model X. And that hasn't been the case for the Model 3, which is, even though Tesla confirmed that they're doing the same thing for it. So even though they're doing the same thing, they didn't get that efficiency gain that they had for Model S and X. So Seth, you think that maybe in the future, just based on software, they could improve on that? I'm more skeptical a little bit because I think they had plenty of time to do that, and if they could, I think they would have just to avoid our own report this week. And we talked to Tesla about this report, like to make sure that we were right about that. And I think if that would have been an option, Tesla would have brought it up that they could have improved on it. They didn't, so doesn't mean it's not going to happen, but I have strong doubt about it. Last quick note on the Model 3 white interior. That was something that you talked a lot about in your review. You were quite impressed with the white interior.
I'm not usually a fan of, you know, different the white. Like I actually really liked it in the Model X. It is just so white. I don't know why that's so like stunning or shocking to me, but it's like when you see
ultra white.
Yeah, it's like for you web developers, it's like FFFFFF. There's like not even a bit of color in it, and it's like bright. So you know, like clearly it's subjective. Like if you don't like your car getting hot, it's good to have white interior. There's a couple advantages to it. The Model X white, it's the same material as the Model X white, and I believe, you know, there's been tests where like people pour ketchup and mustard and stuff on their seats and they wipe it off and it comes pretty clean. And people have had that for like 3 or 4 years, so you can see like a 4-year-old or 3-year-old Tesla Model X with a white interior, and it's they typically stand up pretty well. They stay pretty white. I don't know. Like I'm not usually the kind of person that would spend $1,500 extra on white interior, but it's that
would look good.
Yeah. If I had the extra $1,500, I would.
So the news about that this week is that at first, Tesla was making it an option only available for the performance version. Now it's leaking to the all-wheel drive non-performance version, so you can order it for both cars, not just the like the $10,000 that you have to pay for the performance version before having to pay for the $1,500 more that you get to get that white interior option. So if you guys were just looking for the all-wheel drive, now you can get it in all-wheel, not all-wheel drive, in the all-white interior, which is pretty cool. The next story, so that was for the Model 3 this week. Now we're going to shift to more controversial stuff about Tesla. There's going to be a few stories that were controversial this week about Tesla, starting with our biggest story this week, which was the Montana skeptic story. The guy who we indisposed about the podcast, we called him the leader of the shorts, of the Tesla shorts, which I think is fair. I mean, he was one of the more prominent Tesla shorts, who's certainly the most prominent anonymous one, who's been he's been using the Seeking Alpha platform to write his bear case on Tesla, and he's been very active also on Twitter, where he's been attacking Tesla bulls and been attacking Tesla reporters, and he's been insulting a bunch of people, mainly Elon Musk personally, and also of course sharing his Seeking Alpha article and whatnot. So what happened is that last week a Twitter user by the name of Short Shorts, which I think is from a saying that Elon got together with a YouTube video about short shorts and whatnot when he was...
No, that was actually a famous song back in the day.
Yeah, it was. Elon tweeted that song to mock the Tesla shorts. So the guy created an account about that, and then he doxed Montana Skeptic, who at that point was still anonymous on the internet, even though he was openly shorting Tesla and attacking the company and Elon Musk directly.
I have a question real quick. How does Seeking Alpha know that the authors there are...
They don't.
Oh, so it's just like they're going
on
their work.
It's purely voluntary. They say that they disclose whether you own stocks or not. But I've submitted an article for Seeking Alpha way back, and they don't actually verify it. It's just that you have to disclose it or not.
But so the onus is on the writer.
Yeah. So that's the other thing too. Like, we're gonna get into that. But that user, short doxed Montana Skeptic as being Lawrence Fossey.
Do you know how we found out about that?
Well, I'm not. I contacted that guy, and he didn't get too much into it. But I think it was just like, because he did have a bio on Seeking Alpha, and the bio was really close to what he said. And the profile of Lawrence Fossey, and then you just had to confirm it with a little thing, and I think it was pretty easy. But he was the first one to bring it up, and what he confirmed his job. Which his job is working at RAHR, which I'm not sure how you pronounce this. RAHR, probably. RAR Enterprise, which is the firm of Stuart Rohr, who's a billionaire who became extremely rich by stockpiling drugs and legal drugs, and increasing the price of the drug a lot, and he became a billionaire like that. So after he sold his company, he started a firm just to manage his own wealth, and he hired a bunch of people to do that, including Larry Fossey. And what we learn is that he's actually heavily invested in the oil industry through that fund, including with royalties on with royalties deal with oil and gas company, where you can actually get the signature of Lawrence Fossey on those things. So a bunch of people made it sort of a oil industry conspiracy that the guy was attacking Tesla all the time with the bear case, and he was heavily invested in oil. Of course, I'm not on board with that. I don't think it's actually a conspiracy, but I think it's important that we know that the guy is invested heavily in oil, because just in terms of background and knowing his bias on EV and on Tesla itself, I think it's worthy on its own. But what happened, why the story became big, is because the guy, a few days after being doxxed by the Twitter user, he deleted his Twitter account. And he stopped posting to Seeking Alpha. And then what he said, actually, is that Elon Musk himself contacted Stuart Rohr. I'm sorry again if I don't pronounce his name correctly. And threatened to sue him. Not necessarily, not Rohr, but Fossey, if he didn't stop his attack on Tesla and on Elon Musk directly. And then Fossey agreed to delete his Twitter and stop writing about Tesla and Seeking Alpha. That's what Fossey said. But then Tesla confirmed that they contacted not Elon Musk personally, but even though they didn't deny that, contacted Stuart Warr because they knew him because he was an early adopter, of the Model S, and that after talking to him or executive at the Rare Enterprise, that Fossey agreed to stop his attacks on Tesla. So we reported on that, and of course a shitstorm followed.
it was not pretty.
Yeah. Because of course we had a personal experience too with Montana Skeptic, which we got into in that post. But first of all, a lot of people sort of saying that we doxed him ourselves, which didn't. We have nothing to do with that.
A week earlier doxed. I mean, how would Elon contact him? It was public information.
Yeah, everything was public a week before we posted that article. We were the first media really to report on it. So a lot of people just said that Electrek doxed him or something. That's not the case at all. Then what the other thing that I was quite surprised about is that the way it was framed in a bunch of media, the third that took the story after that, is that they framed it as if Elon contacted his boss because he was criticizing Tesla. So sort of the whole narrative right now in the media is that Elon Musk contacted a Tesla critic's boss to have him fired or whatever, to silence him. So the goal was to silence him and everything. I think that's a very wrong perspective on it, because everybody that's writing that, they are either have a big bias against Tesla or Elon Musk, or they simply haven't been following Montana Skeptic Twitter account at all, because it's not about being a Tesla critic. Montana Skeptic, now Lawrence Foss, was a nasty person on Twitter. He was attacking and insulting people directly, including myself, for months, until the point that I had to actually block him because he was just polluting my feed with insults. So it's not about someone criticizing Tesla. He was being a nasty person. And knowing, since we now learned that Elon actually knew Rar, or actually he knew who he was and everything, because he was an early adopter of the Model S, it sounds to me that it was more about like contacting the person and taking this guy works for you. You should know who he is or what he does, because he's being a nasty person online for what appears to be malicious reason, really. So I think it was more about that. And about the old doxing thing, the fact that we actually shared his name in the article and we didn't now again, I don't think that anyone should have the right to anonymously attack people online and use anonymity, which I think has value, anonymity for plenty of things, like sharing information that could be traced back to your reputation and be damageable to your reputation or whatever. But that doesn't, using anonymity to insult people online, that's not a valid use of anonymity, I think. So we shared his name, and we his, and that's it. And he can respond, but what happened really is that he chose to stop doing what he does as soon as it was linked to his real name. So he must know that what he was doing was wrong. And that's the most important thing. What he was doing that was wrong wasn't shorting Tesla or being critical of Tesla. Plenty of other people are doing that respectfully without any issue, or mostly without issue. I mean, there's still some rabid Tesla fans that are going to attack you even if you're being completely rational. And we don't support that at all, of course. But the wrong part is that he was using his anonymity to just insult people online and being a troll. So that's why we called him a troll to an article, because we actually read some of his tweets. Of course, they're all being deleted. We'd love to have an archive of that, because we could actually give you example, but I didn't need sources for it, because I know it for a fact, because I've been on the other hand of his attacks. And he was a nasty person on Twitter. He was using his anonymity to do nasty things, so...
Yeah, and that's just a higher level thing. Like, I'm happy to respond to people. Do I have criticisms of what we write, or you know, our viewpoint, or whatever? But when you come at somebody as a anon on Twitter and you say something, it's just not worth my time or my like concern. Like, I just don't care. So, like, you know, the more people like Montana Skeptic get outed, I think it's better for the you know, better for the health of Twitter. You know, if you're an anonymous troll and you get, and you see other anonymous trolls getting outed and, you know, going into hiding basically at this point, like, maybe you won't be such a you know,
terrible place,
terrible person. So,
well, I mean, Twitter, terrible place with the Hannons. And
yeah. You know, it would, I think it would be a lot better, I think, if everybody kind of had to have their identity behind what they're saying, so that, you know, you stand behind what you say. You're not anonymous. But,
and it's not to say that insulting people with your real name is better. Well, there's different levels maybe, but it's not better. If you're insulting people online, it's still a coward thing to do. It's just insulting right. people online and not even being willing to put your own name in it. That's just another level of cowardice.
Right.
Because if you look at all the interaction that we have on Twitter, when they are insulting, when they are really, like, you can frame that as an attack, not just a criticism, most of the time they are from the hags, I would call them, because some, most of the time they don't even have pictures, but they're from anonymous people. And you don't have a right to be anonymous to do that. I think it's just, it's awful. So we stand by sharing his name, even though, again, we didn't dox him. We weren't the one that did the reshare. I'm not taking any credit for that. I mean, we'd love to be the one to make that connection and everything, but we weren't. So don't give us credit for that, please and thank you. next, that was another big controversial story earlier this year about Tesla, that Tesla was asking suppliers to reduce costs on existing supply contracts in order to become profitable. So that's the story that came out in the Wall Street Journal. And the way it was framed in the Wall Street Journal is that Tesla was contacting the suppliers with a memo that was saying that to give money back that for payment that they already did, that Tesla already did to the suppliers for contract that was dating back 2016 when Tesla started the Model 3 supply program. Which looks bad when you look at it like that. And I mean, there's nothing special about a supplier looking to get cost reduction. I mean, that's not a supplier, but a company turning to supplier to get cost reduction. That happens just all the time. But the way that the memo was framed, the memo was phrased, is that they were doing it because to help us become profitable during the second half of the year, which of course we know is a goal that Tesla has for the next few months. But then Tesla responded to the report with a lengthy statement, and they sort of clarify the situation, saying that I'm going to quote here: "We're focused on reaching a more sustainable long-term cost basis, not just finding one-time reduction for this quarter. And that's good for Tesla. Our shareholders and our supplier will also benefit from increasing their production volume and future growth opportunities. We asked fewer than 10 suppliers for a cost reduction on the total CapEx project spent for a long-term project that began in 2016, but are still not complete." So that's the important part, I think. "And any change with these supplier would improve our future cash flow, but not impact on our ability to achieve profitability in Q3. So it's saying it's not about making money in Q3. It's about when Tesla gave the supply contract to those suppliers for the Model 3, those suppliers gave a CapEx, a capital expenditure for their specific parts that they were making, and for a schedule in terms of production ramp up, and now they want to revise those CapEx spending based on the current state of Model 3 production. So, like they said, it's a standard part of a negotiation for the supply contract for the Model 3, and basically is that Tesla is in a better standpoint in term of negotiation right now. They have more leverage now that the Model 3 is in 5,000 a week production capacity, and they're now they're trying to push to 10,000. And of course, Tesla has been known to being more than willing to bring production in house when they don't work well with suppliers. So now they're saying to me, it looks like they're trying to see who's willing to play ball with them to get better pricing for the risk out of the production ramp up. So give us a little wiggle room there, and then we'll be friends for the 10,000 a week, which are going to be really profitable for you and whatnot. That's how I see it. I don't know about you.
Yeah, So the Wall Street Journal didn't really even post the letter, right?
No, they didn't.
So it's really hard to get a gauge on like the manner of which they asked for the. It's hard to tell, like, you know, are they like, hey, we need a little bit more money so we can break even, or hey, we met or exceeded our goals, we want to renegotiate our terms based on a higher number of sales. I don't know. It's hard to tell from the information we have. We have Tesla's take on it. You know. Can you believe everything that PR tells you?
No, for sure not. So. But in this case, I mean, it was a reasonable explanation, I think.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I can get to how Wall Street Journal came up with our article too, also, because, I mean, a supplier got that memo and was like, oh, what's that about? And wasn't happy about it, so they sent it to the Wall Street Journal to create the buzz. So I understand where it came from and everything. And from a supplier standpoint too, I mean, they were trying to remove that leverage from Tesla and said, hey, Tesla is trying to do things. So they were trying to create their own leverage and everything. So I understand it's part of the negotiation and everything. So, of course, the shorts made it a big story this week because it looks like Tesla is running out of money and now they're turning to supplier to get some change before the end of the quarter or whatnot. I don't think that's that. But now you know.
Yep.
We are half an hour in and we are moving on from Tesla. We're going to talk for the rest of the hour about other EVs, other EV manufacturer, because there were a few big story or some decent story about electric vehicles this week. An all-electric camper from Nissan.
Yes.
Based on the NV200. So when we talk about all-electric motorhomes, all-electric campers, Electra goes nuts every time. And I get why, because
it's such a fun idea.
Yeah, it is. But, well, motorhomes in general is a fun idea. The fact that you can just pack up your home and just move and explore the world is a big freedom. Cars in their general, when you're 16 or whatever, whenever you get your first car or whatnot, you get your first car, it's a big feeling of freedom. And it's emphasized with motorhomes because you take your home whenever you want to. So there's a big feeling of freedom. So when you had electric, all electric powertrain to that idea, I think it's accelerated the idea of it more because you're also free from gas.
Right.
Because those things are gas guzzler, and especially the bigger one. Now we're talking about a camper, which is more like a van modified with a living area inside of it.
Yeah, and it's a little bit bigger than a Vanagon or a VW microbus. It's full-size van.
Yeah, it is. And what Nissan did is that they took the popular ENV200 van, which is already an all-electric van. And
Did you say popular?
Well, it's popular in Europe, not here. Here, no one knows about it. But in Europe, it's very popular, in Japan too. And they converted it to a camper. Mm-hmm. The problem is that, first of all, it's only available in Spain right now. They only release it in Spain for some reason.
It's very weird.
But it's for sale in Spain, so it's a real product that you can go to your Nissan dealer in Spain and you can configure a custom one and they're going to build it for you. Other big problem is the range, of course. The ENV200 is equipped with a 40 kilowatt hour battery pack. That's actually a new version because it used to be a smarter one, but with the powertrain of the ENV200 follows the Nissan Leaf powertrain. So when the Nissan Leaf got the 400 kilowatt hour, 400, boy, that would be awesome. But the 40 kilowatt hour battery pack. The ENV200 got the same upgrade a few months later. So that gave, they were talking about 124 miles of range, 200 kilometers. It's not great for a camper. You want to be able to go further away than that, I think. It's 'cause even if you get a full charge midday, that's not even 300 miles of range in a single day.
Yeah, so if they continue to follow the Nissan Leaf, we know that the 60 kilowatt is coming out next year. So theoretically, the NV will get the same 60 kilowatt battery pack, and you know that'll help range
a little
by what, about 50%. So that's something, I guess. For me, this is kind of like a shot across the bow of Volkswagen, which has been issuing press releases about their electrification of their product line, including a microbus product. And instead of releasing press releases, you know, although this came via press release, Nissan is actually selling this thing.
Yeah.
So
they built a few ones.
Good for them. Like, get them out there on the streets. Like, you know, maybe somebody will mod it to go, you know, to have a 100 kilowatt battery or something. I don't know. But at least they're out there and it's an option.
Yeah. And we've seen a few things coming. We've seen a German company that got a full size motorhome, but also just a prototype right now with fairly short range. Winnebago released an electric RV platform. So that's more exciting because it's a full size Winnebago. With right now, I think it's exciting because they're making the first step to have an electric platform, but the actual powertrain inside right now is just as bad as this one, really. I think they have like 100 miles of range or something.
Yeah, so it's mostly for like bloodmobiles and stuff.
Yeah, right now they're going to use it for other application, but the platform is there. So if they can partner up with someone that can make a more powerful powertrain, a more energy dense powertrain, they could technically make an electric Winnebago motorhome.
Yeah, and I think these guys, generally speaking, are waiting for the price of batteries to drop. You know, they're forecasting a couple years out. They're putting these things out on the street, getting some testing, and then, you know, all of a sudden, when batteries cost half what they do in a couple years, then it'll make sense to put a huge battery pack in these kind of things.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, we've seen the Tesla electric motorhome based on the Tesla Semi. That was a concept from a designer, so not from Tesla directly, but that was the most exciting one, really, because we already know what the Tesla Semi powertrain can do. So combine that with a motorhome design, which is going to be, even though motorhomes are heavy, it's going to be lighter than pulling 80,000 pounds of cargo.
Right.
And the price is, while it's expensive, the Tesla Semi is expensive, the price is not that expensive when you compare them to actual motorhomes. I mean, we've seen them go up for $200,000-$300,000. The big ones I'm talking about. So the Tesla, one based on the Tesla Semi would be fairly big. So there's potential for it in the near future. I think something like 2020, 2022 or something like that. We're gonna see the first commercially available electric motorhomes that are competitive with the gas powered version.
And then of course Elon had talked about in the master plan model part two that Tesla had sites on a microbus type of bus product.
Yeah, but that was for transit, though.
For transit.
It was like for putting a bunch of people in it. I don't think it was a...
Well, you could always convert those.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyway, Jaguar and the I-Pace, last month, you were in Portugal to test that car, and you came back very impressed. Like most people so far, are very excited about the I-Pace. It looks like a stunning vehicle and decent enough powertrain in it. We reported this week that there's some delays on the deliveries. Not every order is a delay, but we got contacted by a bunch of reservation holders in the UK, which we assumed were going to be the first market for the vehicle since it's a British company. And some of them are seeing some very significant delays, up to 4 months, 3 to 4 months. We contacted Jaguar about it. They said that the production is still planned for late summer as usual, but they did confirm that some customers will experience delays based on the prioritization of market-specific orders. What does that mean? It's not clear, But based on our sources, apparently they are short on supplies of some parts, especially the Matrix LED lights that they have for they offer as an option on all version and standard on the first edition version, which is the more expensive one. And those are the people who are getting delays. So it sounds like they are prioritizing the first editions to get those Matrix LED, but they didn't plan for enough of them. So now they are forced to delay some orders. So we'll see. Because some people that contacted us, they were getting like a production date in August and delivery dates in September. And now they're being told like you won't get your car until 2019. So that's kind of
which
a bummer.
Has to suck. That's I mean that's winter, you know. That's
yeah.
That's going to be a bummer for a few people. And you know, I have a feeling that Jaguar is underestimating demand for these.
Oh, for sure.
You know, Waymo alone is getting 20,000 over the next 4 years. But you know, almost every review I've seen of this, and of course my own. Drive of this car was extremely positive, so I think perhaps that a lot more people are ordering these things than maybe Jaguar had anticipated, and they're kind of scrambling to meet demand.
Yeah, exactly. That was my take too. What this shows, it shows high demand, and it shows that Jaguar wasn't ready with the supply for some of the most popular option on the car. And we don't know how many they are planning. We've heard anything from 10,000 to 30,000 units per year, but like you said, Waymo's already ordered 20,000 of them, or they are have the option to order up to 20,000 over a few years.
Yeah,
I mean, knowing that you should boost production. I mean, that combined with your customer orders, you're pretty safe. Even if demand ends up dropping for whatever reason in a year or two, and there's other option on the market and whatnot. With that 20,000 orders from Waymo, I mean, you're good to go for a while, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they have a year or two of already, like, even if they don't sell anything else, like, what they don't sell one car outside of Waymo, they're already a year and a half to 2 years into production. That's crazy. Mm-hmm.
I think some of the issue is that Jaguar is not actually building the I-Pace themselves. They've contracted Magna in Austria to build it at their plant in Austria. So that creates a major supplier to work with, because they're the one that actually are assembling the vehicle. Of course, there could be plenty of other bottlenecks from batteries to apparently LED lights. So could be plenty of issue there, but it adds another difficulty that you're not actually assembling that vehicle yourself. So they had to have contracted production capacity with Magna, which is a great they're a great manufacturer. Like they assemble a ton of cars from mainly European automakers. I think they are also behind some of the BMWs. They're a very big company, so they know what they're doing. But some production capacity limitation are very likely. Moving on to Audi. Audi e-tron Quattro was the other all-electric SUVs, the SUV that was supposed to come out this year. So, because the European automaker right now, they're very focused on their first all-electric entries to be SUVs, really, with the I-Pace, Jaguar with the I-Pace, Audi with the e-tron Quattro, Mercedes with the EQC. So, the premium SUV space is being electrified very quickly. And Audi's is entering the market is the e-tron Quattro. It was supposed to be unveiled this summer, but then their CEO got arrested. over the Dieselgate scandal. And right after that, they pushed the unveiling date. I was seeing the unveiling date. We've seen the prototype like times and times again.
Yeah, actually, you sat in it.
Yeah, you sat in it. You saw it at the. Was it the Formula E event?
Formula E in Brooklyn. Yeah, they had one there. If anybody there went, they could sit in one and you know go around it. One thing I'll note about the e-tron versus the I-Pace, the e-tron is way bigger. Like the e-tron is like a proper SUV, where the I-Pace is more like a car with jacked up wheels.
Yeah, a higher suspension.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. It looks more like an SUV than the Jaguar does. But so they pushed that, and yesterday they confirmed the actual unveiling date. That's going to be they're calling it the global debut of the production version, September 17th in San Francisco. So,
and my understanding is deliveries won't start until 2019.
They said that in a press release, but in the U.S. So that was a press release for the U.S. that it won't come out on, it won't be in dealership until 2019. In the U.S. The car was supposed to come out in 2018, so maybe in Europe it's going to be there in 2018, because I know they want to build it in Belgium. So if they build it in Belgium, maybe it's going to be available in Europe first. We don't know for sure.
If it's like every other vehicle, it'll be in Norway first. And then,
yeah, it's always in Norway first, right?
We gotta move to Norway, at least this summertime, maybe.
Yeah, it looks like it. It makes sense. So especially the European automakers, they all go into Norway first.
Right.
And the Japanese ones, too. The other thing about the Audi and the e-tron Quattro, excuse me, is, we could start talking a bit about the specs of the car, too, because we know from the specs based on the concept vehicle, and they said that the concept vehicle is going to be close to the production vehicle, but on September 17th, we're going to have all the final production specs. So take everything with a grain of salt here. They were talking about a 95 kilowatt hour battery pack, two electric motors for a total output of 320 kilowatts. So a significant powertrain for like sort of a performance SUV. DC fast charging capacity up to 150 kilowatts. So they would beat the Jaguar. Is capped at 100, right?
It's not even 100. It's like you need a 100 kilowatt charger to get the most out of it versus a 50. But I think it's actually in the 80s or 90s.
Oh, really? All right. So for this one, it's up to 150. And we know that a bunch of charging stations now are coming up with 150 capacity. Not all of them, but most new ones are able to 150 to 350.
Yeah, actually, technically, it's faster than Tesla's if it can actually go to 150 kilowatts, which we'll wait and see on that.
Yeah, well, if it comes out in 2019, that might not be the case anymore because of the supercharger V3, which is supposed to come out later this year. But nothing is confirmed at this point. In terms of pricing, that's probably the biggest spec that we want to know. So, because that 95 kilowatt hour is a big battery pack and able probably close to 250 of range, it's. It's not their biggest SUV in the Audi lineup. It's sort of a mid-range SUV, a little bit over the mid-range maybe. So we are looking at the price. The only price that they confirm is in Germany, €80,000. But that's has to include the taxes there. So we don't know. Maybe like something like... and euros are higher than the US dollar right now. So I'd like to see it around 70,000. That's what Jaguar is doing, the I-Pace in the U.S., starting at 70,000 before tax incentive, like the federal tax credit.
But yeah, I mean, it's a little bit bigger of a car. I think it's going to, it's got a little bit bigger of a battery. It's probably going to cost a little bit more. I would say 75.
Yeah. $75,000 to $80,000 starting price before tax in the U.S. That would surprise me. But I would be very happy to see that closer to 70, because it's like if they want to compete with Tesla, I think the e-tron Quattro will compete more with the Tesla Model X than the Jaguar compete with the Model X in terms just of segment. The Quattro is significantly smaller than the Model X, so if they want to be more competitive with it, I think they should reduce the price a little bit, but we'll see. They started making the motors for them. Audi announced that this week. They have their Audi Hungaria, where they have a factory where they already make a lot of the ICE powertrain for the ICE engines for the car for their lineup of gas powered vehicles. Now they started production on electric motors, and they have a significant capacity of 400 electric motors for axles each day. Per day. So I know they didn't specify their shift and everything, but they said they won't go one for three shifts. So I assume that 400 per day, you can probably double or triple that capacity. And but the Quattro has two motors per car, so you have to take that into account. But I mean, I think Audi can probably churn out like 20,000 more vehicles per year for the Quattro.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that Audi's doing a little bit more like Tesla, where they're doing it all in-house, building their own motors and manufacturing as well. I mean, it's in Hungary, but it's still an Audi factory.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think most people are going to do their own electric motors at this point. That was just the same thing when I was at BMW last month. They emphasized that it's important to make the, to have their own expertise in motors. Where people are more skittish about getting into is the battery cells, really. I think not a lot of automakers are willing to do that yet.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a commodity. It's a hard thing to get into, especially when the Chinese and the Japanese and Koreans are all making very inexpensive, high-quality batteries. But yeah, you know, clearly Tesla thinks it's going to need so many batteries, it makes sense to build their own factory, and I think that's probably a good idea.
Yeah, and even then, we always, it's always weird to say that Tesla is in battery cell production, really, because it's still very much Panasonic's expertise, and Tesla is just getting more involved than most automakers into the battery cell manufacturing. But it's still Panasonic cells, really. Just develop it in partnership in terms of the chemistry with Tesla, and Tesla owning the actual land where they're making the cells.
Right. So their gigafactory strategy is kind of like McDonald's strategy, where they own the land where the McDonald's are, but they don't actually own the thing. Anyway, So we're almost out of time. There's one really interesting story left. The NIO is courting Tesla owners with mobile charging stations built inside electric vans, which seems like a great idea.
Yeah, it is, really. We've seen AAA do that in the U.S., but with generators, they have little generators, and if you're stuck, and it's really about if you're stuck. This one is about just getting a charge. So if you're at work and you feel like you don't want to go to a supercharger or whatnot, you call them up. They go to your car while you're still at work. You just unlock your charge port and they plug it in for you, charge you up, and then you can get back home or wherever you need to be with a charge. And they're actually doing it with, like you said, electric vans. So it's everything is electric. It's not the generator inside. It's actual battery packs inside that they transfer the energy to your own car's battery pack. So I think that's pretty cool. How much it costs? About $25 per charge. They say that it brings you about 10 minutes, 100 kilometers in 10 minutes of charge, which is pretty fast, really.
What would be cool, though, is if Tesla would allow you to use your Tesla to charge somebody else's Tesla. Mm-hmm. If you could do that, that would actually be a great way of reducing range anxiety, I guess. You call your buddy up and say, hey, I'm over here, I'm out of, you know, I'm running low on juice, you mind? It wouldn't be optimal, and range anxiety isn't a thing, really, if you have a 300-mile car, but you have that in your back pocket. You know that worst case scenario, you can call somebody and they can bring over their Tesla and you can charge them up. So
yeah,
it would make sense. I don't know why
they talked about doing it. Elon Musk did a few months back.
That's so right.
They're considering it for sure. Just not a priority right now. I understand why. But so where we see that NIO is courting Tesla over that is that the actual service has been designed for them for their own fleet. So they're coming out right now with their own electric SUV on the market in China, the ES8, which is a cool-looking car. A little bit smarter than the Model X. They're trying to fill that gap in the market with an electric version of a somewhat luxury vehicle that starts at like $42,000. But that's without the battery pack. So they have sort of like the same scheme as Renault with the Zoe, where they sell you the car, but you don't own the battery pack. You rent the battery pack with a cost per month.
Which is $200.
So, yeah, it's expensive. So,
but I mean, when you think about how much you spend on gas, it's not crazy.
Yeah, because you can also because that's one thing. The mobile charger is one thing, but they also have a battery swap station like Tesla did back then in San Francisco, a little bit outside of the Bay Area actually. And you can just go and exchange your pack, and you don't care as much about your pack if you don't own it. So you can just switch it with whatever pack that NIO has at the battery swap station. So with that, I've never been a fan for the battery swap concept, but I am more of a fan of it if you have that battery renting scheme, I think. But that's another thing. It's a hard sell too, so I don't know. We'll see how they do with it, but
yeah,
so far they seem like
it also brings to mind that company called the Israeli company called A Better Place that used to do the battery swaps, but went out of business. I wonder.
Yeah,
if this is like a reincarnation of that.
Yeah, they went out of business, but they might have been a little bit too ahead of their time too, because they were very dependent on electric vehicle adoption, and that was like what, back in 2010 or something. So
yeah,
it was like there wasn't any EV around, so they weren't very in the right condition for success there. NIO has their own electric vehicles, so they contribute to their own success with the battery swap program and their fleet. So they build on top of each other, which is pretty cool. We're gonna keep an eye out for NIO, and if we're ever in China, which I think we should go at some point soon, because just how crazy the EV market here is there. We should check them out, and they have global ambitions too. So we're gonna probably see them outside of China soon, in a way. Before we go, the last thing we should mention is my hat, the Boring Company. I know last time we were on the podcast, we talked about going into a Boring Company tour and writing about it and talking about it. And we did go on the Boring Company tour, and it was awesome. The only thing that wasn't awesome is that once we got there, they said that everything is off the record. We cannot talk about anything. We cannot take any picture and whatever. So we cannot tell you anything about our whole Boring Company tour. Are there then is going to be some news that it can come out soon, and then stay tuned and whatnot. But yeah, it's a real bummer. I mean, and it was very cool, so cool that we really wanted to talk about it and share it with our audience on the podcast and on the blog. But they weren't open to that yet, and I feel bad. You know, I felt really bad because they didn't say that, but the way I feel is that we weren't able to talk about it, and because they said we were the first people, the group of people were the first people outside of SpaceX and the Boring Company to visit it, instead of company insiders, if you will, like people around the company and whatnot, to visit the tunnel. And since we were the media, if you will, and everybody else weren't the media, everybody else was just like people that won the hat. And we did won the hat too. That's how we got there. It's not because we were invited as media, but because we were media and they knew that we were going to talk about it, they said that we weren't going to take pictures, everything. So I think that the way they saw it is that it would be unfair to other media because I won through the contest and get to report on it.
It's really annoying. Like the amount of stuff that we can't do because they're upset about hurting the feelings of other
media outlets, yeah,
is like, it's way too high. Like,
yeah,
like it's just really frustrating. Like most of the time,
same thing with Tesla too. Like a lot of jealousy is around, and
and like for instance, that Model 3 performance review would have been way, 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 way better if Tesla wasn't worried about offending the sensibilities of other writers. So
yeah,
that's how it goes.
So it's a bummer for you guys that we cannot share it. It's a bummer for us too, because we wanted to share it and everything. We did share about the SpaceX competition. So if you follow that day, was pretty cool, but a little bit underwhelming. I mean, the first two runs, especially, they completely failed and weren't great. But the last one ended up actually beating their own record. So that was cool. And they had some great technology there too. If we talked to a few students.
Yeah, that was probably the coolest part is the technology.
Yeah. So that was fun. But then later at night, we went to the Boring Company. We got a whole tour of their installation and what they were doing there. And we cannot talk about it, which is frustrating.
Yep.
But at some point, we should go back on the official media tour and be able to talk to you about it. So then we're gonna update you. Or if they have a change of heart and let us talk about it, we have plenty to say. Until then, we're going to talk to you next time. So thank you, everyone, for watching on YouTube, for listening on your podcast app. Thanks a lot to our Patreon supporter at patreon.com/electric. We're going to see you same time next week. Bye-bye.